call the meeting to order. Now that we have a few members here and present, I don't know what we're competing against. The others are trickling in, though. Yesterday we had...
The environmental rally over
the Capitol. Oh, geez, I missed that. I've overlooked it. Okay. today, our first presentation is by Commissioner Lehman from the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Board. And Jean Valencik, who's also she's the Director of Administrative Services now. And both from up on the range. Welcome to St. Paul and welcome to the committee. Commissioner, if you want to begin, you can just go right into your presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you all have in front of you copies of a PowerPoint that I'm going to run through here in the next couple of minutes. It might be easier for you to actually look at the hard copy than the screens, as I see it's a little hard to view the screens. But I will run through electronically as well. What I'd like to do, I understand that many of you may not be familiar with our agency. The agency has actually been around for about more than 65 years. We were formed in 1941. And we're sort of a unique agency because our purview is really a region of the state. It's of the mining lands in northeastern Minnesota. And our funding does not come from the general fund, but comes from tax on the production of taconite. And so I thought I would take this great opportunity to appear in front of you today to give you an overview of what the agency is all about. Our agency purpose, first of all, is briefly to advance regional growth in the former mining and current mining lands of northeastern Minnesota. We do that through four strategies. We're first and foremost an economic development agency, and so our first strategy is business retention and expansion. Second strategy is the diversification of the economy through business development and recruitment. The third strategy is actually in state law, and that's to enhance future opportunities by reclaiming former mining impacted lands. And finally, we obviously want to position our agency to continue to be a leader in the region, and so that has to do with fiscal responsibility and the organization itself. So how do we do that? We do that by positioning ourselves in the value chain and looking at the agency as a business, if you will. Our inputs are primarily tax revenues, and I'd just like to show you the four main areas where the agency derives its revenues. And you'll see here an annual average of about $34 million come into the agency each year. Now we're talking about 1 year at a time. And we'll talk about a biennial budget in a minute here. First of all, we have the taconite production taxes that flow to the agency. Secondly, about 38% of those funds are actually just passed right through our agency. We administer a tax rebate program where the money goes back to the taconite plants on the Iron Range for reinvestment in capital improvements. Then we do have some investment earnings on the Douglas Johnson funds, and we have earnings from loan revenues because we do make loans. We have a large loan portfolio, and this represents the principal and interest earnings on an annual basis. And then finally, we do own two facilities. We own the Giants Ridge Recreation Area and Iron World, and do have revenues from both of those facilities. So what is the value add that the agency brings to northeastern Minnesota? Well, first and foremost, we are a financer. We do make low interest loans, grants, and some equity investments in businesses. Secondly, we're a promoter and a marketer of the region. We're a communicator within the region and on behalf of the region. And we are a convener. In the times of crisis or times of opportunity, we serve as a regional convener of ideas and of actions. And finally, you might ask, okay, so what are the results? Looking at the period of time that I've been commissioner from early 2003 through mid-2006, will give you a snapshot in time. What are the results of the agency being the financier, for instance? Well, for businesses, we've made $53 million worth of loans and investments in businesses. And by doing that, we've actually leveraged a little less than $350 million in other private and public investments. The result is 2,500 new jobs and a little less than 2,000 jobs retained in that time period. For mining companies, you'll see here that over $40 million has passed through the agency in that four-year time period back to the mining companies for capital investments. For communities, in the four-year time period, $12 million in grants have been made to help communities and nonprofits. So how do our strategies work, and how have they worked in the last 4 years? Well, when you look at what's driving the economy in northeastern Minnesota, it's a very different situation today than it was 4 years ago. And at the top of this sheet, I talk a little bit about the situation 4 years ago, where we were facing steel bankruptcies and mining closures, versus today, when the mining companies are going at full production and we're actually looking at some new facilities coming online. So a little different set of circumstances. With the business retention and expansion strategy, we've served as a convener and a connector in the case of steel and mining bankruptcies, and helping for the assets from those companies to be redeployed, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. In our diversification efforts, we've served as a financier and a facilitator to capitalize on new markets. In the third strategy, we have served as a grant maker to help the region be prepared for the future. And then finally, as an agency, we have gone through a reorganization to help us be prepared to serve the region in the future. Now, the members of this committee may not have time to do a lot of TV viewing, but to help you remember a little bit about how we do our work, I'm using TV television shows as the theme here. In the first case, when we've been working with mining companies, I like to call that Survivor, because that's really where we were 4 years ago. It was, are we going to have a mining industry in the future? Are we in a survival mode? Those were the questions being asked. LTV was bankrupt, was closed, 1,400 people were out of work. National Steel was in bankruptcy. And when I came on, FTEC was in bankruptcy. Hundreds of people were out of work, and the future did not look bright. But today we have LTV lands and facilities open for reuse, and we're looking actually at two projects, Mesaba Nugget and Polymet, that are looking at reusing those facilities. National Steel is reopened as Keytac and purchased by U.S. Steel. And FTEC, as some of you may know, was reopened by Cleveland-Cliffs and Liwu Steel of China, who has a third ownership in what is now called UTAC. So a little different circumstances. Deal or no deal is the second slide. And this, to me, represents some of the opportunities that we're working on right now. It seems sometimes in economic development you're always in a deal or in negotiations. But we have some very exciting projects that Iron Range Resources is serving as the convener for and the financier for. Mesaba Nugget, Minnesota Steel, Polymet, Franconia Minerals represent value-added iron, steel making, and non-ferrous mining opportunities. We're also really poised to take advantage of some of the interesting opportunities in energy, both with Laurentian Biomass and our investments, early investments in Excelsior Energy. And then finally, on the diversification piece, we've had some success with our customer service centers such as Blue Cross Blue Shield, Delta Dental, and small manufacturing is represented here. Third, I'm calling back to the future, and that's looking to our past to create a new future, where we've been working with our local communities and mining companies on preparing a new landscape, turning pits and piles into lakes and lakeshore in the future. And our grant making helps to a large degree in this area. And we are working very closely with the Northeast Higher Education District in coordinating workforce efforts to prepare Northeastern Minnesota to survive and thrive in the 21st century. And finally, Extreme Makeover is an apt description of what's been taking place within the agency as we've reorganized and repositioned the agency for the future. One of the things that we just completed in the last month was transitioning Iron World to a nonprofit management structure, where a new nonprofit has been formed. Community stakeholders have been brought in to plan a new future for the Iron World facility. Our agency still owns the facility, but it will be managed, and the new vision for the future will be laid out by the new nonprofit. So on my last two slides, I would like to talk about the biennial budget that you have in front of you here. Our revenue sources, as I talked about in the first slide, really come from four areas. The investment earnings on our loan and investment earnings on the Douglas Johnson Fund represent 12% of our revenues. Our facilities revenue also represents about 12%. Taconite production taxes that come in for use by the agency are about 40%, and then a full 36% actually pass through the agency in the form of tax rebates. Representing our projected expenditures over the next biennium in a similar pie chart, we see again the pass-through funds, the operations, the facilities representing Iron World and Giants Ridge, and the programs and projects at 27.3%, for a total biennial budget of $86.7 million. And there I would like to stop and take any questions that the committee might have, Mr. Chair. And I do have Jean Galensik is the Director of Administrative Services. She, as part of our reorganization, oversees both our finance department and our human resources, so she has a pretty good handle on the biennial budget.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Lehman, you mentioned some new economic developments just with the taconite industry up there, or what are they?
Yeah.
Commissioner.
Well, I mentioned that the taconite industry itself is doing well, and that has a lot to do with the global market and what China's demand is currently. We have six production facilities on the Iron Range that have been operating at full capacity now. So that's, you know, a good piece of news. Plus, they've been reinvesting at historical levels, which is what we like to see. If the infrastructure is being renewed, we know that the life of mining will be extended. But beyond that, the agency has been involved in early stage development of a few value-added projects. One is Mesaba Nugget, which you may have heard about. It's making iron nuggets that feed a whole new market. Iron nuggets feed electric arc furnaces, whereas taconite pellets taconite pellets feed open heart furnaces. The second one is steel making. A Minnesota steel plant is being proposed for the old Butler pit in the Nashwauk area. Butler Mines was closed down in the 1980s. It's a very rich ore body that is just waiting for someone to utilize. And so we're really excited. The agency has been involved in early stage development loan making for Minnesota Steel. And then further east on the Iron Range, we're looking at some non-ferrous, that's non-iron mining in copper, nickel deposits in the form of Franconia Minerals is doing some drilling and exploration. And probably first on the horizon for commercial opportunity is a company called Polymet that would be mining copper, nickel, platinum, palladium in northeastern Minnesota.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Representative.
You know, I know the primary purpose for the Iron Ring Resources is to get money and get industrial development taking place in the range area. We have to do something to prepare ourselves for when taconite and steel industry are no longer viable into the future, hopefully a long time from now. But what are we doing in that regard today that will not wean ourselves off of taconite and hopefully steel making very soon?
Mm-hmm.
But what kind of diversity are we bringing to the economy of the people of that area?
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair, for that question. That's really important, and it's a balance for our agency because while the job numbers are dwindling in mining and in papermaking and timber-related jobs, those are still the best-paying jobs in northeastern Minnesota. And so the balance that we face is trying to keep those jobs for as long as we can. But facing the fact that over the past 5 years, those job numbers have diminished by 30%. And so you have to face that fact. If you're looking at creating jobs, it's not going to come from those natural resource-based industries that have been around for 100 years. But they may come from value-added representatives. So number one, we're looking at adding further value and opening up new opportunities. Then secondly, we have worked with the Northeast Higher Education District to hire a workforce coordinator because we think that workforce is the key. Workforce is the key to the knowledge-based economy and to the service industries that are actually 80% or more of the jobs in Minnesota today and will be in the future. So to answer your question, our emphasis will be on preparing the workforce in our region for the jobs of tomorrow. We may not even know what those jobs look like today, but we do know that we have to have the young people and the current workforce trained and ready for those jobs of tomorrow. And then I will say that we have a recruitment effort and we have a business retention and expansion effort that works with the businesses that are on the Iron Range right now. Yesterday, Governor Pawlenty was in Hibbing to celebrate one of those success stories. It's a subsidiary of Industrial Rubber that is completing a $6 million expansion with the involvement of our agency and the JobZ program, where they are manufacturing specially lined pipe to service the oil sands industry in Canada. And to bring a really interesting project, to bring oil back to the U.S. from the vast oil sands area of Canada.
I just look at the resources that they have up there. Not only do they have jobs, these and the things that we have all over the state, but you also have an economic development fund that's rather substantial to lure industries in there. I would think that between the two of them, you have a formula for great success. So I'll be looking forward to seeing a lot of new manufacturing industries as well as a few service industries. They're used to good paying jobs, so maybe some of the service industries won't fit. But I really look with the tools that you have up there, you should be the most successful in the state.
Well, Representative Gunter, someone was a lot more foresighted than I am, although I do look at the presentation and there's a couple of my bills that help preserve those plants and that, and some legislation I passed. But, we, because of the cyclical nature of the steel industry, this agency gets funding to prepare for the day when there isn't going to be the natural resource there, unlike, your farmland, which produces wealth every year. This just keeps reducing our wealth as they mine it out. But we've got other projects like the non-ferrous minerals, and if we don't get stopped in our tracks by some groups that don't want to see that type of mining in Minnesota, that could be a very prosperous endeavor for the state. And I might add that the Butler Taconite plant that she mentioned, or the Butler Taconite area, ironically, that mine closed back right before I got elected to office, and it got torn down before the guys actually had their layoff notices. Since that time, we passed a law that they had to keep these taconite plants in operating condition for a year. It was at first, and then with the LDD closing, it was extended to 2 years. There's a bill floating around here that's going to try to do the same for Ford Motor Company, because it helped keep those two mines open that Commissioner Lehman mentioned. But ironically, on that proposed Minnesota Steel site is a lot of Permian University Fund land. And if it got mined, it would be kicking in dollars into the Range Scholarship that was mentioned here by President Brunix and others. So that'll help. But as far as some of the other things, I'm not a big supporter of Job Z myself, and it hasn't really worked in our area that much. I understand it's worked a little better in your area, but it's not a tool that we can use that much because it doesn't apply to any mining.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I think I'll bring you a list of all the jobs and projects that are in your district, Sertich's district, and the surrounding area. It surprised me.
Well, I don't think we have much. Well, we can talk about that later. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fisher, could you tell us the western edge of your service area? I represent a district that includes the western Itasca County, and there are a couple projects that I think would benefit greatly from your agency's support, and I'd be interested to know if they're in fact eligible and how to go about plugging them in.
Well, I'd be happy to talk to you.
I can answer that when he talks to us. That's an easy one, Representative Mahone.
I got a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will do.
Representative Mahone.
Commissioner, is it physical location or is it the number of residents that have moved into my district from the Iron Range? Maybe I can get in on, you know, Representative Moe can. Never mind.
Well, actually, Representative Mahoney, we wish they didn't have to move into your district, but it's only the only reason that you actually do fairly good in an election is because of those Iron Rangers.
Move them into mine.
Well, Commissioner, thank you very much. Ms. Zelensky, do you want to say anything since you came down all the way from the range?
Chairman Riccobino, no, thank you. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is our state providing a good workforce for some of these new jobs that are going to be coming up in the area?
We are really excited about the opportunity. And as I mentioned, working with the higher education facilities, we think we're well positioned to be supplying the workforce that we need. I think some of the projects that I talked about earlier, the Minnesota Steel project and the Polymet project, if these projects come to fruition, it'll be an opportunity like we haven't really seen since the late 70s, where we had some large projects bringing young families to the Iron Range. And so I think it'll be a mixture of new opportunities for existing residents, but it'll be a wonderful opportunity for us to attract new residents to the Iron Range as well.
Thank you.
Representative Welke. Thank you, Chairman Riccobino. I know that the steel industry or the mining industry is very cyclical in nature, depending upon what's going on across the globe. And luckily, we have China and India and other Asian countries that are using the resources right now. But if we go into another recession, especially up in the mining area, I know that my fellow colleagues from the range had made us quite aware of the thousands of people who were laid off in the past. And this was only 4 years ago or so that they had a really bad spell. Were you able to put most of those people back to work up on the range with the growth in the mining industry over the past 4 years? Can you kind of give me an idea how many left the range, how many stayed on the range, and how many went back to higher education institutions to get retrained?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'd be happy to follow up with you on very specific numbers. I don't have those numbers with me today. During the 1980s, we lost significant numbers of people. When LTV closed down, it was somewhat of a different story. 1,400 jobs were lost. But we did track where those people went, and we did learn from that, and also from the Blandin Paper Company shutdown of two paper machines, that we were able to retain many of those residents, which showed us that we had been somewhat successful in diversifying the economy, because we were able to find jobs, and jobs with benefits, the health insurance benefits that were so important to families, to keep families in northeastern Minnesota. So that's really the measure, is when you have a downturn like that, which we will, is what happens to those people, and are we able to retain those residents and other jobs? I'd be happy to follow up with you on specific numbers. Don't have those today, but it's very important. One other piece I would like to mention, I think it's something that is unique to northeastern Minnesota, is we are also looking at high-speed fiber connectivity in northeastern Minnesota. I think that, together with the workforce, will be key to positioning us to take advantage of what comes our way in the 21st century.
Representative Welty, what happened at LTV with the 1,400 layoffs is a lot of them were 30-year employees. They did get they qualified for pensions, unfortunately, because their pension got thrown into the Pension Benefit Guarantee Board, the federal, quasi-federal agency that handles bankruptcies and defined contribution pension plans. A lot of them just took their retirement. Others went back to school. A lot of them went back to school, and I know a lot of friends that, had been out of school for 25 years and went back and got degrees in nursing and things like that, because we have an aging population. So they went into those fields, and coincidentally, we had Blue Cross and Blue Shield hiring at the time, and Delta Dental, and so some of those people went in there. And finally, the other mines that are still operating were reaching levels where a lot of their employees are right now retiring. In fact, Inland Steel, which is just north of where I grew up, I can see the plant right from my parents' house. They're retiring about 10 people a month right now. And there's only 400 people at the plant, hourly workers. And that's how many people are retiring, because they're hitting that 30-year mark where they get a full pension. So the commissioner, one thing she's done right, I will say, admit, is I work with Representative Sertich's father up at the airway system, and they hired jointly between our community college system and the agency, hired a person who's supposedly working with the mines now to try to get our students right out of the technical colleges and into the mining era, the mining field. But those kids still need a little more training. As an example, to get trained as an electrician at a technical college, and when you're trained in some commercial electricity, but then you go out there and you're working with voltage, that is pretty dangerous, is a whole different story altogether. Or driving a 250-ton production truck that's a couple stories high to get up into it is a little different than the training programs that they have at the colleges. Commissioners, you want to add?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chairman, you make an excellent point, and this relates to all of rural Minnesota, I believe, because of the demographics that we're looking at and the baby boomers, retiring. We are really going to need to focus on our educational system and training our young people for jobs in Minnesota. And those who want to stay in rural Minnesota and have an opportunity to do that need to be aware of the opportunities. And one of the things that this individual that's working in the workforce issue is doing is working to retain those young people, run them through our community colleges or our tech schools, and employ them where they're able to in rural Minnesota.
Thank you, and Chairman Rukavina, I just want to say I think you're doing a great job up there, and definitely the IRRRB and the funding that comes to the agency is needed. And I think it's critical that you continue to diversify your economy up in northern Minnesota, so that the people who have been there for generations can continue to stay. And I just think it's critical. I've been up on the range before. I think it's a wonderful place, and I referred to it earlier as one of the gems in the state of Minnesota, and so I'm just wishing that you well in your endeavors to diversify your economy, and hopefully if a recession comes along in the near future that we are not expecting, we don't have thousands of people unemployed. Rather, we have people that can go to other jobs, and not only that, they can find the resources to retrain and to get other degrees to move into other industries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And thanks for the presentation. And speaking of rural Minnesota, I would like to welcome the 12th grade class from Princeton High School. That's where you're from, and that's who you are. Welcome to the Capitol and to the committee. And, these are the students that are going to... How many of you are going to go on to a higher education institution next year? Well, make sure you get some planning on your debt. members, these are the students that are going to be affected if we don't do something to get a handle on that skyrocketing tuition. Representative Denver, did you have a question?
Yeah, the students from Princeton, make sure you say hi to my brother who teaches at Princeton High School, Mr. Detmer. Just tell him I'm the better looking one, though.
We're not going to have to sneak you out the back way to keep the kids from getting in trouble, are we?
And how many of you have gotten detention from his brother? Okay. Next, we have the Bureau of Mediation Services. Welcome to the committee. Come on down. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am James Cunningham, the Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services. And you have in front of you our a packet of information regarding the Bureau. I will give you a brief overview. I will apologize in advance. I am not the most creative person in the world, and so after following up Commissioner Lehman's PowerPoint, we have a plain black and white paper presentation.
But that's fine.
But what I lack in creativity, I make up for in brevity. So I will be brief and entertain whatever questions that you may have. The Bureau of Mediation Services is the smallest cabinet level agency. We were initially created in 1939. Despite the fact that we are the smallest cabinet level agency, we are responsible for promoting constructive labor relations throughout the entire state. Our employees travel from St. Paul to every county, city, and municipality in the state, providing services. Our service area is in three primary areas. They are mediation, where we will send a person out that will assist a public sector employee and a public sector labor union when they have bargained kind of face-to-face to the point that they can't make any more progress. They call us, and then we will send someone there, and we will assist them to find a resolution to their differences to the point that they can agree on a contract that both of them can live with. Just to give you a little sense of the actual numbers that we worked with over the past four calendar years, our agency has received over 2,500 petitions for mediation services, some from employers, some from unions. And despite 2,500, we've had, thankfully, only eight public sector strikes in the last 4 years. And I will point out that three of those strikes happened before I came on board. So I think we provide a very valuable service to the citizens of this state. The potential, I think our impact is a lot greater than our size. Our efforts directly affect thousands of public sector employees, and probably not an exaggeration to say we have a positive benefit of tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of potential lost productivity if all the public employers and public employees can't resolve their disputes, and we end up with public sector strikes, things of that nature. So mediation is probably the meat and potatoes of our agency's functions. We do have some other functions as well. Our second one is our representation function. That is a kind of a quasi-judicial service that we provide. We come and we send hearing officers to listen to disputes with regard to the makeup of individual public sector unions, which employees should be included, which employees should not be included. If a union disbands or if a new union comes on, we act as a quasi-judicial capacity to help them resolve their differences again. The third primary area that we work in is our labor management cooperative efforts. That is where we send people out to meet or do training to basically allow employers and employees to find ways to work together collectively. It has been our experience over several decades that if we can set up a situation that we can teach or help employers and employees learn to work together, it has a positive impact when they come back to the table and do their collective bargaining negotiations, because they've oftentimes had some shared successes and had some victories together. And that oftentimes we found has a positive spillover when they come back together to do some collective bargaining. So those are the three primary areas. We have a couple of ancillary functions. We maintain the list of arbitrators that are used throughout the state for labor relations type cases. We also provide training all over the state with regard to the things that would make both employers and employee groups more effective in their collective bargaining efforts. One of the things that we have really been a champion for here in the state is our interest-based collective bargaining program. And that is a relatively new phenomenon. It's colloquially known as a win-win bargaining, as opposed to a traditional bargaining where usually someone wins and someone loses. We try to, when appropriate and when we're able to, assist parties at engaging in win-win bargaining so both sides can get something that they can live and grow with. With regard to challenges for the agency, we have several. One is we're always interested in trying to help both employers and employee groups deal with some of their challenges with regard to health insurance and retiree health insurance, things of that nature. We are always scouring the internet and seminars, et cetera, to see what new ideas come up in that regard, so we can try to provide a service to help the parties deal with those issues because they are really struggling. The other thing we're dealing with, like a lot of agencies, we're trying to continue to find ways to utilize our employees as efficiently as possible. Like I said, we go all over the state providing services, and we're always trying to find out if there are more efficient ways to do it. But thus far, that has been the model that has been the most successful for us, and so we have continued to work in that regard. In summary, you have our copy of our agency's budget. All of our budget comes from the general fund. I, as commissioner, can speak on behalf of the agency. We're going to continue to do what we can to provide the services that we provide to the citizens of the state in the best manner possible. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to entertain any questions you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Mahoney. But before Representative Mahoney, Commissioner, I just want you to know today, you know, I just want you to tell us how hard was Gunther on you when he was chair of this.
Representative Gunther was a delight to work with.
Okay. Representative Mahoney. But that didn't answer the question. You know, Representative Mahoney.
I've been doing this for 4 years. That's kind of how it works.
Mr. Chair, I would suspect that he will find you as delightful to work with, as he found Mr. Representative Gunther to work with as chair, and in the end, you both, all three, will have served the state well. I, on the other hand, Mr. Commissioner, was looking through your presentation here, and on page 6, number at the top of the page, you've got developing and maintaining a roster of labor arbitrators. One of my questions for many of our departments to have people like you would have in your division, highly skilled, somewhat specially skilled people. What's your turnover rate? I mean, it sounds like you're having a trouble maintaining people long term. And if you are, I'd like to ask a question or two.
It's really not the fact that we're having trouble maintaining the number. Quite frankly, it's a little bit of an opposite. One of the challenges for us is to find qualified people that can come in and provide this service. The threshold, we have a fairly high threshold. In order to be a mediator in our office, you have to have been the primary spokesperson for either your union or your employer for 5 years. That's a pretty significant threshold for people at that level that would come and work for the state. All of the people except for one since I've been commissioner who have left have all retired after decades of service. And so we have frankly, a very stable workforce. It just happens to be that in the last 4 years that I've been here, we've had more retirees than we've brought people on board. And the other issue is, even if you meet the threshold in terms of the years of service, mediation, quite frankly, is more an art than it is a science. And so you can have someone that'll come in that'll have the requisite experience on paper, but they will have to learn the art of mediation. And so that's a fairly broad learning curve. And, we really don't expect people. We're actually going to post for a position within the next couple of weeks. We will not expect that person to be able to take their own caseload for several months. It'd be well into the fall before they're able to, they've got enough experience as a mediator to go out and mediate a case by themselves. Because our mediators don't go out in a group of people. They go out one at a time to, kind of out in the hinterlands to work with the parties where they are. And so, you really have to teach them a lot about how to be a mediator. So it's just a time factor. We lost a mediator in December, and that's the one we're going to post for. But like I said, we won't be able to send that person out independent until well into the fall. So, if that answers the question, I'm trying to.
No, but it tells me that former legislators probably shouldn't apply.
Representative Mahoney, I got the exact opposite impression. I thought Representative Gunter and I could, being on one side and me being on the other side of the philosophical fence, and we'd learn how to mediate, and then we can get our high five up too, right?
Well, that actually leads to my other question, but I think one of you would make a great mediator.
Well, no further questions?
No, I have one other question. One of my concerns with public employees, particularly at the state level, and I know we had some bigger issues in the past with senior management, senior employees leaving, and in your case retiring, and you said part of the problem of replacing them is the qualifications. I guess I'm going to ask, is your pay scale comparable enough for commensurate with the level of skill in order to attract those people?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it is, in fact. We have a fairly broad range of salaries. The people who are at the top of the range making what I think is a good salary for public employment. We're a little behind our counterparts at the federal government. Federal Mediation Conciliation Service does what we do kind of at the federal level, and our salaries are a little below theirs, but not significantly. I don't believe that is having any bearing whatsoever on us that there are always, we always have a list of people who are interested in being mediators. When we post this position, as we're going to do in the next couple of weeks, we already have 10, 20 people who have, without even know there is a position open, who have said, when a position opens, please contact me. So there's a ton of interest in these positions. It's just a matter of they simply don't open up very often because the employees stay for a long period of time. And then again, there's a fairly high threshold in terms of experience. So it wouldn't be the money as much as the experience.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
I'll ask it a different way, or I'll ask it a third question here. In a dollar figure or a percentage, how much less do our state mediators make than they would make in the private market, and how much less in a dollar figure or a percentage do they make than the federal mediators?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know the exact numbers. I just kind of have some anecdotal information. I have contacts with my counterpart over at the Feds, but we've never pulled out salary schedules to compare. So I don't have an exact figure. I think my thoughts are being somewhere 10 to 15% lower than they're paying at the federal level. But that again, is not based on any hard data I've looked at. That's kind of off the top of my head.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gunther.
Thank you. You gave me a great segue, Representative Mahoney. What do you think of an organization that hasn't had a pay increase, state employees that haven't had a pay increase for 8 years, and have absolutely this year especially had a workload increase substantially? Do you think that's a good case for mediation? And I know I've never had one complaint about your work, but I was just curious if you think that would be a good case for you to take on.
Well, that case, hypothetically speaking, would obviously present some challenges. I mean, one of the things that we have to deal with right now, quite honestly, is managing expectations. There's an expectation, I think, generally speaking, amongst state employees that there is money to be had. But, you know, the fiscal realities of the employers may be something different. And so that is one of the challenges we're going to have to deal with, is how to manage those expectations.
Mister, so, I think he was referring to this agency and a number of people that, as their own labor negotiator, aren't willing to give themselves a raise.
I would say if we could provide some service, we'd be happy to talk to you.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions about page 3, I guess, of the background information. You've got key measures here: percentage of collective bargaining contracts and grievance disputes settled through mediation. Target goal is 90%. And on the next page, where it's the bargaining units and representation disputes requiring elections that are processed within 90 days, goal is 90%. Just curious about how you come up with the 90% goal, and is that based on some certain criteria? And is that, I see that you've gone above 90% and certainly a higher amount, 97% in the ones with the elections. I'm just curious about that.
No, I really inherited that number. That was in place when I came on board. The previous administration had set some targets with regard to, I believe, Governor Ventura's administration. And when I came on board, I looked at them and I thought, you know, they kind of explained to me how they came up with them. And there wasn't any hard science. They had kind of, the previous managers had tried to set some aspirational goals, kind of saying, in a perfect world, what would this number be? And they set it at 90, and when I came in, I didn't see any reason to change it. I thought that was, you know, gave us something to measure against, a hard number, but yet, you know, it was something that was attainable as well, even though, if I'm looking at page 3 of the overview, in 2004 we were at 82%, so we weren't able to do that. But again, you know, you have to kind of look at that in context of what was going on. That's in fiscal year 2004 was when there had been several cuts in the state government, et cetera, and you know, a lot of employers and employees were not able to really reach kind of deals that both to live with. They had issues that that kind of prevailed throughout those, and so it had a negative effect on our overall number of settlements. But as you see in each of the subsequent years, it has gone back up, and that's what we're looking at as our major success.
Just one follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have performance measures that individual mediators are required to meet as far as, that their caseload would be at a certain percentage?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not. My deputy commissioner does the majority of the assignments of cases, and we keep a running tally that we check monthly in terms of what mediator has how many cases, where the cases are, because, again, we're trying to get some economy or some efficiencies with regard to how we deploy mediators. So it's not, for example, it's not conducive to have someone have a case in Bemidji and then turn around and send them to Rochester the next day. So we work in terms of how many cases they have and where they are, trying to be as efficient as possible. So to answer your question succinctly, Representative, we do not have a performance numbers for mediators.
Representative Haas, did you have a question?
No, it's answered.
Thank you then, Commissioner. Appreciate your testimony, and we'll see what we can do with some of your requests here.
Great.
I'll give you as much new money as Representative Gunther did.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again, Commissioner. Representative Huntley, welcome to the committee. Pleasure to have you here, and Representative Hortman moves that House Bill 398 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus higher education workforce development omnibus bill. Welcome, Representative Hortman.
A pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair. House Bill 398 deals with tuition reciprocity between the state of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin. Under the current agreements that are in place, if you happen to be a Minnesota kid and you decide to go to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, you pay the tuition to the University of Madison that you would have paid to the University of Minnesota. If you are a Wisconsin kid that decides to go to the University of Minnesota, you pay the University of Minnesota the tuition that you would have paid to, in this case, to Madison, because that's the comparable institution. If you're talking about a four-year college, again, it's a comparable tuition to what you would have paid in your own state. The problem with that formula is that you can have two kids sitting next to each other on a Twin Cities campus, one from Minnesota, one from Wisconsin, and the Minnesota kid's paying up to $2,000 more per year for tuition than the Wisconsin kid. If you've ever talked to any parents that are helping their kids pay their tuition, this is an issue. There is, however, a supposedly settling up at the end of the year, and if Wisconsin, in effect, owes Minnesota money, then that money is paid to the state, but it goes into the general fund, does not go to the university or to St. Cloud or whatever, Bemidji, I see. And so it goes in the general fund, does not get go to the educational institution in Minnesota, so that that institution, whichever one it is, in effect has lost, in the case of Twin Cities, about $2,000 a year in tuition money that they could have used to fund that institution. So this bill says that the university in the future, that kids coming from Wisconsin will have to pay the same tuition as Minnesota kids do at the University of Minnesota. And it's phased in over 2 years. Starting next fall, they would pay the difference in the tuition rates would be cut in half, and in the second year, they would pay the same tuition. And there are people there from the university to talk about this issue.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Representative Huntley before we bring down the folks from the U? Representative Gunther.
Thank you. Representative Huntley, there is a projected decrease in the students available going to higher education institutions in the future. I think we're looking about 7 to 9 years are supposed to be starting to decrease significantly. Would this have a tendency to have more of Wisconsin students stay at home, in your opinion?
Representative Huntley.
Well, I guess I'm not an expert on that, but it would depend whether there is, whether this agreement between Wisconsin and Minnesota is eliminated completely, or whether there is some further agreement. I suppose that if a what this would do in some cases would raise the tuition for a Wisconsin kid going to a Minnesota school in the order of $1,000 to $2,000, and you're probably right, that might be a deciding factor for some kids.
Okay. Mr. Zetterberg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Peter Zetterberg. I work for the University of Minnesota. I'd like to begin by thanking Representative Huntley for House File 398 and the support it provides for an issue that is a concern to the University of Minnesota and that we are anxious to see fixed. As Representative Huntley indicated, the current agreement with Wisconsin is problematic for us in that the difference between what Wisconsin reciprocity students pay and Minnesota residents pay to attend one of our four campuses has simply grown to a point that it is ridiculous. It's not a situation we believe any other state would tolerate. When this gap was smaller, it was not really that much of a concern to us. No agreement is perfect, and we were able to accept this for a long time, but especially in the past 5 years, the difference has become so great that we think it's time for the agreement to be changed. Let me say that reciprocity itself is certainly not the problem. The state of Minnesota has always, I think, benefited greatly from its reciprocity agreements. I think it benefits in two ways. First of all, these agreements provide prospective students and their families with a much greater choice of educational opportunity than would otherwise be the case. Secondly, if you look at statistics regarding the net migration to Minnesota of people with a baccalaureate degree, or the net loss of people from states like Iowa, for example, North Dakota, South Dakota, with a baccalaureate degree, what you really are seeing for the most part is the fact that most Minnesota students who go to school in a reciprocity state come back to Minnesota, and a relatively high percentage of students from reciprocity states who come to Minnesota stay here. Our own studies indicate that at least 30% of the students from North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin who come to school in Minnesota, whether it's St. Cloud State or Bemidji State or our Morris campus, wind up staying here. And that is very unusual. That is a very high percentage of students who remain here. And that is the other way that the state's reciprocity agreements have benefited the state for a long time. So we certainly have no intention of harming reciprocity in any way. We just think that the current agreement, as is often the case with contracts between two parties, has gotten to a point where it no longer really makes sense for one of the parties, that's the state of Minnesota, and we would like to see that changed. We believe the change we're seeking is reasonable. We're not asking that Wisconsin residents would pay more than Minnesota residents would pay. We are asking only that they would pay the same amount as our own state residents pay. This is the way the state's other reciprocity agreements do work. The South Dakota agreement, the Manitoba agreement, the North Dakota agreement, and even the Wisconsin agreement for graduate students does work the way we'd like the agreement to work for undergraduate students, where students pay the higher of the rate of the campus they attended or of a comparable institution in their own state. So I simply want to say that we think the change that we've requested, the change that the legislature asked the Office of Higher Education to seek in the 2005 session is a reasonable one. At this point, negotiations are still ongoing. Despite what you may have read in the newspapers or heard on the radio, those negotiations still are ongoing. We remain hopeful that this situation will be resolved, as has always been the case in the past. A lot of people think that the Wisconsin Reciprocity Agreement has been the way it is since 1968, and that's not true. It has been changed on numerous occasions. There are always technical changes every year in an annual memorandum of understanding. So, as has been the case in the past, when one state has asked the other for a change, we hope that that's what's going to happen. But we also do appreciate the fact that Representative Huntley and the other sponsors of this bill are concerned about the issue. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone might have about the current situation.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina, members and presenters. I think it's time we do this. I can understand how it has gotten out of control over time as our tuition has gone up and perhaps at a rate a little bit higher than the state of Wisconsin. So I think it's time that we do this. And to Mr. Gunther, Representative Gunther's point, perhaps if we can do a good job in this committee and in the future of holding the line on tuition, we will not have the discrepancy that he referred to that may drive people out. So it's my hope that we can work hard on that in the next year or two and see that that doesn't happen. And I did receive calls when news of this hit the paper several months ago, and I just am looking for confirmation that this will not affect what our students do in Wisconsin. This is simply affecting the Wisconsin students that come to Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
The change we are seeking would only change the rate that students from Wisconsin would eventually pay to attend the University of Minnesota campus. It would have no effect whatsoever on the tuition rates that Minnesota students currently pay in Wisconsin, nor would it have any effect on their opportunity to attend a Wisconsin institution.
Representative Norton, but it's not to say that if it was implemented that there wouldn't be some type of movement by Wisconsin towards Minnesota residents. Mm-hmm.
Chair Rukavina, I do understand that, but I just want to be very clear that our action today is not with that intent. Our action today is to support the University of Minnesota in the loss of revenue.
Well, Representative Norton, I appreciate Representative Huntley bringing this bill forward because it makes a point that should be made. But Mr. Zetterberg, you said in your presentation that this is problematic for us, meaning the U, and that it's ridiculous, and if I remember Representative Brunick's exact words, it was perverse. Mm-hmm. But you can solve this tomorrow without us doing anything, Mr. Steinberg. Right? You don't need this legislation. You can just tell Wisconsin we're done. And
Representative Rukavina.
And then my division doesn't get booked for $4.5 million.
Representative Rukavina, as I said before, I'm hopeful that the current negotiations will be successful. That would far and away be the best outcome. We have, in fact, however, explored other alternatives. And one of the alternatives that we have explored is the possibility of, as an alternative, offering our own form of tuition benefit to students from Wisconsin. In other words, simply allow as an enrollment management practice Wisconsin residents to attend the university's campus and pay a resident tuition rate. We have not taken that proposal to the Board of Regents. We hope we don't have to do so, but in fact we do believe that that is an alternative we have.
Representative Gunther, did you want to?
Well, basically, Representative Norton asked half of my question. The other half is simply, why don't we pass a law that says instead of the money going into the general fund, it comes into higher ed at the university. The money that is a difference.
Representative, not to, because I think we have some county procedures that supposedly we have to adhere to, but maybe Mr. Byrd, could you help answer that question?
Mr. Chairman, you're basically,
Novak, maybe
you're on the right track, which is if there is a loss of revenue to the general fund due to legislation, someone will be credited with that cost. If we do it in this committee will foot the bill.
I've got an idea. We'll do it in the Health and Human Service bill. Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair, it'd be a decimal point in my bill.
That's all. Exactly. There you go. That solves the problem. Representative Mahoney.
Let's see if I can make this microphone buzz again. You know, Representative Gunther is trying to be the mediator one more time. Looking for that high five, I can tell.
Amen.
Here's my question. Could you tell me what the rise in tuition cost over the last 5 years have been in the University of Minnesota system, percentage-wise?
Yes. Mr. Satterberg.
Over the last 5 years?
Okay, well, four, five, whatever.
Over the last 5 years, it's been about 70%.
Could you tell me what the raise in tuition has been at the University of Wisconsin system?
It's been about the same. I can tell you for certainty that over the last 10 years, the increase on the Twin Cities campus has been 110%, and the increase on the Madison campus was 120%.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Could you tell me where this $2,700, I think it's $2,700 or difference is? In tuition costs, and why is Wisconsin less than Minnesota?
The $2,700 difference is actually on the Morris campus, but in general, I can certainly explain why I believe tuition at four-year at Madison is lower than it is on the Twin Cities campus. I point out, however, that it's much more the fact that Wisconsin is lower compared to all Big Ten institutions with respect to Iowa than an issue of just being low in comparison to the University of Minnesota. Tuition on the Twin Cities campus is exactly at the midpoint of the Big Ten. It's not as though it's way out of bounds. But it is lower on Wisconsin, and I think that that's for three reasons that have been in play, not just in the past year or the past 5 years, but over a long period of time. The first of all is the structure of higher education and tax support for it in Wisconsin, which is very different than it is in Minnesota. A lot of people look at just state funding for higher education, but in Wisconsin, $600 million in property tax dollars supports their technical colleges. And when you include that in the mix, the funding for higher education is actually better in Wisconsin than it is in Minnesota. It's also not the case that tuition for all undergraduate students in Wisconsin is less than it is in Minnesota. Minnesota's tuition at community and technical colleges is very high. It ranks third nationally, but it's even higher in Wisconsin. It's second nationally. So it is not the case that undergraduate tuition in Wisconsin is uniformly lower. There are many students for whom it's higher than it is in Minnesota. The second general reason for the difference in tuition rates has to do with two other state policy issues. One is financial aid and one is reciprocity. Minnesota, like other Big Ten states, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, has always placed a great deal of value on providing need-based financial aid to low-income students. Wisconsin and Iowa do not do that to nearly as great an extent. Funding for financial aid, need-based financial aid through the state grant program, is twice as much as Minnesota as it is in Wisconsin. The legislature has always thought that that was a high priority. We certainly agree with that. But a consequence of that is that more of the state's available support for higher education goes to financial aid than it does in Wisconsin. The second general policy issue has to do with reciprocity agreements themselves. The state of Minnesota has surrounded us with states and provinces with which we have tuition reciprocity. Those are the natural areas from whom we recruit students. So virtually all of the non-resident students we have on university campuses pay either what Minnesota residents are paying, or in the case of Wisconsin, they actually pay less. The situation for Madison is very much different. Madison has about as many non-resident students as the Twin Cities campus does, but they all pay more than Wisconsin residents do. And many of them, the students, the 2,500 students from Illinois, for example, who come out of Chicago suburbs, pay the full non-resident rate. And the fact that you have large numbers of non-resident students at Madison paying that non-resident rate is probably the major factor that allows Madison to keep its tuition lower than all other Big Ten campuses, with the exception of Iowa. And then the third reason, again, is simply geography and history. Madison sits 2 hours from one of the biggest markets in the country, Chicago. And it has always been able historically to draw a lot of students out of the state of Illinois, out of other parts of the Midwest, because of its closer proximity to them. And again, those students are paying a full non-resident rate. On the Twin Cities campus, again, most of our non-resident students actually pay less than what Minnesota residents pay. So it's a combination of those factors. It is not something that has just happened in the past year or the past 5 years or even the past 10 years.
Okay. Representative Mahoney, I'm going to let you ask one more question. We've got Representative Hodge, Detmer, Nornes, and Poppy, but I would like Ms. Hegart to come down and weigh in on this while you're asking your last question to Mr.
My only... Has this been... My daughter went to Madison. She told me that she paid much less going to Madison now. She's been out of Madison for almost 9 years. Has this been a problem for a really long time, or is it just in the last 4 or 5 years?
Chair Rukavina, certainly for the past 10 years, there has always been a gap of some time between the Twin Cities campus rate and the Wisconsin-Madison rate. I don't actually happen to know exactly what it was 9 or 10 years ago. But
hey, I'm going to... Why don't you just stay put, Peter, and then come on up, Susan, and then we'll take the representative's questions in the order they're on the list right now. And I'm sure they're for you, Peter, so, but we'll see. Maybe they'll be for Ms. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Susan Hegart. I'm the Director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and a number of my comments have already been made by Mr. Zetterberg and Representative Huntley. But there's a benefit in Minnesota, as was said. Our students have broader choices because we have reciprocity agreements with our surrounding state, and that's been something that's been held valuable for several decades. Our agreement with Wisconsin goes back to 1968. Our office reviews these agreements every year. We're the primary negotiator with these various entities in our surrounding states. But the agreements are approved by each system's board. So the system then has to agree, MinSCU and the university has to agree whether or not they like the agreement and the pieces that are included in it. We have been negotiating very hard to reach an agreement with Wisconsin. We've put forward a proposal. I'm going to walk just quickly through Representative Huntley's bill. There are several pieces of it that are consistent with the proposal we put on the table with Wisconsin. The director of their office, my counterpart, and I have traded several letters, and those are obviously available to you if you would like to see those letters. But we've gone back and forth late this fall and this winter trying to reach an agreement. The piece that we've put on the table is similar to Representative Huntley's bill in several respects. We would be commencing in the fall term of 07-08, however, his bill suggests 08-09, but the practicality of the matter is that we probably would be bumping it out to 08 and 09. You flip the bill over. There is a piece, though, that would be a significant change to the reciprocity agreement that we currently have, giving preference to Minnesota residents. The admissions piece is another element of reciprocity. It's the cost piece, but it's also open admission. The same admission requirement is supposed to be given to Minnesota students as is given to Wisconsin students. So that would be introducing a very new element into this agreement, and that's not currently in our proposal to Wisconsin. Finally, the phase-in that he's suggesting is 2 years, and we've put on the table with Wisconsin a 4-year phase-in at this time. So I just wanted to make sure that you understood where what we've put on the table versus what's laid forth in this bill. One of the problems is that if a law is passed here, there isn't really an impact on Wisconsin, in that they've got their own body to pass laws and things. So you could choose to pass this bill, but I guess one thing I would just say to you is that it really reflects currently what we've put on the table with Wisconsin. It's gone up to the very highest levels of government over there. We've been talking about it with our governor's office here. And so, as I said, we're in the middle of negotiations. We hope to have this thing wrapped up by February. Our goal is to keep reciprocity in place. We think it would be very unfortunate for this agreement that we've had for a number of years to fall apart. One of the questions we have is if the university decided to sort of not just pull out, but have their own reciprocity agreement, what would the reaction be on the Wisconsin side? You know, a group of schools that's affected in Minnesota that's not really talked about much are the Minsky institutions. There are a number of Minsky institutions that have a significant number of Wisconsin students attending those schools as well. So it would be really important for us to understand fully the impact on those schools too. Winona is one that I can think of where half the students roughly come from Wisconsin. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. I just want you to know that we've been working hard on this and that it's gone up to the highest levels of government, and then we're just hoping for a solution by the end of the month. I also have with me Jack Rayburn, who's our agency person on reciprocity. He understands the nitty-gritty and the technical aspects of the work that we do on reciprocity.
Ms. Hegart, I guess, begs the question, if it's been a problem for a while and you've been working hard at it, what makes you think it's going to get done in the next month as opposed to nothing having happened for quite a while?
Mr. Chair, we put a proposal on the table, a formal proposal on the table to Wisconsin in November. So they've had the proposal. They received it in November, and they've been taking a look at it. And as I said, we've gone back and forth. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to reach some kind of a compromise, but, you know, we'll see.
Representative Haas.
Thank you very much. Educate me here. This really got complex. It looks like it's so complex. Why wouldn't it have had started just saying that if you're Minnesota and you go to Wisconsin, you're considered a Wisconsin resident, you pay the resident fee, and vice versa? How did it get so complex?
Brilliant minds have a different way of looking at it. Who wants to answer that?
Well, Representative Haas, one thing I would say is that each agreement with each state is a contract, essentially. We have a separate agreement with South Dakota, a separate agreement with North Dakota, a separate agreement with Wisconsin. I haven't been around long enough to tell you why the Wisconsin agreement is drafted up the way that it is. Our agreements with South Dakota and North Dakota state that you pay the higher of the two tuitions, and that's where those are drawn up. This agreement states that you pay your own in-state tuition.
Regent Center, Representative Rukavina, Representative Haas, I'm much older than Ms. Hegart is, and I do know a little bit of the history.
In the system, not age-wise?
The agreement once was just exactly what you suggested. Throughout the 1970s, you simply paid the resident rate of the campus attended. It was changed in 1983 when the state changed a whole lot of things about higher education. And the reason for not simply going with the resident rate is to make sure that there's not a financial incentive for a student to leave their own state. So, in other words, we wouldn't want an agreement where Minnesota students could go to Wisconsin and pay the lower Wisconsin rate. So the North Dakota, South Dakota, Manitoba agreements, we believe, have it right. You pay the higher of the rate of the campus attended or of a comparable institution in your own state. But the rationale for that is simply so that there is no financial incentive for a student to leave the state. If you want to go to Madison, fine, but you shouldn't do so simply because of the price.
Thank you. That does somewhat make sense to me, which scares me. okay, now my next question. I have one last question. Is the Wisconsin non-resident rate, how does that compare to the Minnesota resident rate? The Wisconsin's non-resident rate, How does that compare to the Minnesota rate?
Representative Rukavina, they're both about $21,000, and they're within $100 of one another.
Eventually, then, when a Minnesota person can go, he says, I don't want to do it this way. I want to pay the non-resident rate. It's equal or less than. You know that we could reach that if this keeps going in that direction?
Representative Rukavina, Representative Pauls, I cannot envision a day when Minnesota's resident tuition rate would ever approach Wisconsin's non-resident rate. I don't think that that would ever happen.
They're, Mr. Chair, they're not approaching it now?
No. They're
how far apart are they now, Mr. Chair?
They're about $13,000 apart.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Detman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What is the per capita taxpayer spending in Minnesota versus Wisconsin?
I think it might be, Representative Detmer, a little hard to...
For higher education.
But it might be a little hard to determine that because, okay, as Mr. Sterberg said, they have one system over there as opposed to...
Okay.
But maybe Ms. Seagard can help give us somewhat of an apples-to-apples comparison? Or?
You know, at this point, I'm not comfortable giving you an answer. I'd be happy to have our folks take a look and talk to others and come back with an answer for you to that question, but I'm not comfortable in taking a stab at it.
I would suspect, Representative Detmer, that if you took into account the technical colleges and the two-year institutions are still on the local school district property taxes like our tech colleges used to be, it would be pretty similar, if not, you know, maybe a little higher there. But if you want to, Representative, we can have them try to get you some information like that. Okay?
That's fine. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I just have one point. There was a question about grandfathering that was brought up by one of the members here. And what I wanted to say is whether the agreement stays or goes, which we hope won't happen, there would be grandfathering structured on a phase-in process. There would also be, there's grandfathering written into the agreement. In the event that the agreement comes apart, there's a phase-out process that allows for grandfathering and protecting students who are part of the agreement. So that would be a caveat on both sides, I would say.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question was to Mr. Zetterberg. I didn't get your role at the university.
Mr. Chair, I work in the provost's office, and most of my work involves tuition and financial aid.
Okay. All right. That's what I gathered, but I just wanted to make that officially clear. My experience on this committee has for me concluded that reciprocity has been a problem for as long as I've been on it. And Representative Opatz was one that championed right. trying to fix it, and he's not here anymore. So it continues. My concern with the bill basically is that. You know, if we've been doing this in contract form and negotiating form, if we do it in legislation, I don't know what that does. It seems to me it kind of blows up everything potentially. So I would be cautious myself in guess, taking the lead from the higher education office and how we should handle this so we don't make it worse.
Well, I think part of the goal here might be for blowing things up, but... Representative Huntley, any comment? Are you trying to pull a Rukavina here, or what are you trying to do?
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to have two kids sitting next to each other and on the Twin Cities campus pay the same tuition.
And the UMD campus.
Okay.
Which is the cheaper one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question about the Section C, where it does talk about the preference. Just intrigued by that and wondering exactly what that means as far as criteria or percentages or just how that came to be and what the background is and what the criteria might be and how significant that is.
Representative Huntley, is that your answer, piece to answer there?
Well, I would let Mr. Zetterberg respond to that.
Yeah, Representative Rukavina, this provision is actually in this bill at our request because we think the current agreement is vague on whether or not either state can do this. We believe that Madison should be able to give preference to Wisconsin residents in making admissions decisions. We believe that Eau Claire should be able to give preference preference to Wisconsin residents in making admissions decisions. We think St. Cloud should be able to give preference to Minnesota residents rather, and we think the Twin Cities campus should. Some people might read the agreement and say, well, you already can do that. We just think it's a little vague, and we had suggested that maybe the language should be specific on this point. I also believe that this is a matter that might be handled in the annual memorandum of understanding.
Mr. Chair, could I just...
Before you do, Representative Poppy, would you move a minute?
I would certainly do that.
Thank you. Any additions or corrections, members? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Poppy.
I just wanted to have Ms. Hegard also maybe respond to that because she brought it up as one of the reciprocity issues. So.
Ms. Hegard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, we would be concerned about this new element being introduced into the agreement itself. You know, if there's a conversation that the university wants to have with its counterpart in Wisconsin, that's fine. We could talk about that. But introducing this element into the agreement troubles me because it basically then begins to limit choices for students. And what we're trying to do is provide more choices for students in this state and for students from Wisconsin to come here. For every action, there's usually a reaction, and my concern would be what would happen on the other side. Which schools would decide they want to have preference, and would some be open admission? I'm concerned about this piece of this proposal.
So, Ms. Hegard, your opinion isn't the same as Mr. Zetterberg's as to whether or not you have the authority right now to do that?
It's not written explicitly into the agreement. It's
but, I mean, we're an independent state. I mean... You mean you don't think that Minsky or Mankato or whomever couldn't decide, well, we're going to give Minnesota residents preference right now? That's what Mr. Zetterberg kind of indicated.
My understanding, and I'd ask Mr. Rayburn to help me out with this, is that, you know, part of the goal of reciprocity is, again, to keep choices open and even. So there's parity in both states, whether it's North Dakota, South Dakota, or Wisconsin that we're dealing with. So. I think if we found that an institution, if there's problems with institutions right now giving preference, we'd like to know about those situations and we'd like to have discussions about that. But to my knowledge, that's not something that we've been focusing on or facing in the current agreement. It's not going to...
I think it's more of a general question, I think, than trying to be answered. Representative Welch, and then we're going to adjourn.
Chair Rukavina, point of parliamentary inquiry. Are we going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, or are we going to take this up and pass this out?
My motion was to, I think Representative Hartman's motion was to lay it over for possible inclusion.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions then? If not, thank you very much for the information and presentation and bringing the issue forward. Representative Hartman, meeting adjourned.